The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
And the way you look tonight.
Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, candidates. Monday, June 7th. That music means it's the birthday of the fetching Mrs. Hewitt. Happy birthday to my child bride, who catches up to me this year.
And your cheeks.
Catches up to me today and this year. We were born in the same year, so she's going to have a great day today. She loves birthdays. Some people love birthdays. Not me, but she does. Took care of it. Welcome, America. Welcome. It's good to have you here. I hope you had a great weekend. A lovely weekend inside of the Beltway. I hope you had a wonderful weekend inside of the Beltway. Not a lot happened. I mean, really, genuinely, not a lot happened. When the first story is Joe Manchin says he will not support changing the filibuster rules or the Democratic voting rights bill, and that's the lead story. Not much happened because Joe Manchin has said that many times before, and after a week or so, the media begins to buzz around him again, the Democratic liberal media, trying to get him to change his mind, and he says again no, and he writes an op-ed no, and here's why I'm not going to vote against the filibuster, and all of a sudden we get the Washington Post. Manchin will not support Democrats' voting rights bill, he says in an op-ed. Manchin vows to block Democratic voting rights bill, preserve the filibuster, he says in the New York Times. The Financial Times, Democrat senator says he will vote against Biden voting rights bill. So, you know, when you learn is the number one thing that someone who's already against something is still against something, that means it was a slow news weekend. And it's going to be that way. This summer is time to relax. Yes, you're still going to work. Yes, you're still listening on the commute. You're still getting the rundown loaded every morning. But he's not the only one. Jake Tapper had Senator Angus King of the great state of Maine on yesterday. Here's what Angus King said, cut number 11.
Not in general. I'm very reluctant about it. But if it comes down to voting rights and the rights of Americans to go to the polls and select their leaders versus the filibuster, I'll choose democracy.
But it's not going to come down to that because there aren't 50 votes for SB1. So what Angus is doing is what a lot of senators are doing. They don't want to be out front like Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema. Maggie Hansen won't vote to change the filibuster either. And I doubt very much that Senator Kelly from Arizona would, but somebody should ask him. They should ask every Democrat. Dianne Feinstein is not going to change it either. She's known the senator her whole life. She's not going to change it. But that was the lead story. As a result, we get the Wall Street Journal reporting Biden's agenda takes on steep GOP resistance in the Senate. Again, not really a news story. The Republicans don't like the things the Democrats want to do, like spend a lot more money, raise a lot more taxes, unconstitutionally deprive the state over control of their elections, leave the border open, defund defense, or at least don't fund it to at least keep up with inflation. They don't like any of that stuff, the JCPOA. So, of course, they're not going to advance the agenda. And no, the filibuster is going nowhere. So we're basically done until the reconciliation comes up again. And reconciliation is a math thing. If it involves math, money, you can get it into a reconciliation budget, even if you stretch it a little bit. If it's talking about taxes and budget, you can get it into a reconciliation, passes with a simple majority if you get all 50 Democrats. Hard to say that's going to happen. So a couple of think pieces came out. USAID to Central America hasn't slowed migration. Can Kamala Harris ask Natalie Kitzroff and Michael Scheer of the New York Times? The answer is no. She can't slow migration. And then Frank Bruni in the New York Times yesterday, headline, Kamala Harris can't win. And this is my argument that I made on the Washington Post on First Look show on Friday when Jonathan Capehart asked Don Edwards and I, isn't Kamala Harris doing a great job? And I said, no, look, they've stuck her with immigration. She can't win on immigration. They stuck her with voting rights. She can't win on voting rights. They're killing her with her assignments. Then a New York Times Democratic report raises 2022 alarms on messaging and voter outreach. It's a review of the 2020 election conducted by several prominent Democratic advocacy groups. It's concluded the party is at risk of losing ground with Black, Hispanic, and Asian American voters unless it does a better job of presenting an economic agenda and countering Republican efforts to spread misinformation. What a nonsense. Democrats are going to lose in 2022 because Democrats always lose in the first off year of a new president, as Republicans lose when they have the presidency. This is not, gosh, it's not rocket science. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky urges parents to vaccinate teens, pointing to increase in severe cases. We would have been better off, had she not said this. Because parents are getting their teenagers vaccinated. And Dr. Walensky, God love her, blew her credibility early with a couple of U-turns made very publicly. From the Financial Times, Anthony Fauci under siege. Well, yeah, he is. Those emails were not helpful. Exactly the opposite of what is helpful. And you can't really erase the emails after they come out. And the emails just show some stuff he wasn't forthcoming about. Secretary Pompeo was on with Laura Ingraham, I believe, Friday night, said this cut number 17.
You know, I'll leave that to others to speculate. But when you heard Dr. Fauci this morning, Laura, those are the exact same words, the exact same excuses, the exact same theories that the Chinese Communist Party has been presenting for over a year now. We can all draw our own conclusions. I know this. We had a group inside the State Department, Miles Yu, a handful of others working diligently to get this information out to the American people so the world could see what the Chinese Communist Party had done to all of us.
But Tony Fauci is taking his lumps. I still like the doctor. I don't think he intentionally misled anybody. Some people disagree. I genuinely think most people try to do their best in an early stage of a pandemic that no one knew what to do with, and we're getting better at it. A judge in California reversed California's ban on AR-15. And you've seen the liberal media goes out and says he compares it to a Swiss Army knife. Yes, he did in the first line. The opinion has got very little to do with Swiss Army knives and a lot to do with the fact that the Supreme Court has not articulated a basis on which to evaluate local and state laws on guns. And he is saying if that basis is other than something called rational basis, where you give every law a pass, it has to fall. If it's a fundamental right to own a gun, the sorts of restrictions that California has on the AR-15 will not stand up. And he's asking the higher courts to please tell us. New drug for Alzheimer's approaches a final FDA decision. Aducanumab is aiming to slow the progression of memory and thinking problems early in the disease. If approved, it would be the first new Alzheimer's medication since 2003. But the FDA is just really not wanting to do it. In November, a committee of the FDA voted overwhelmingly against recommending approval, saying that it failed to demonstrate persuasively that aducanumab slowed cognitive decline. Now, three members of that committee dissented and wrote a great critique. Others say, no, it's great. We should try it. Here's the deal. If you've got an early diagnosis of Alzheimer's, and my father-in-law died of it, you want to try anything. I sometimes just don't understand the FDA. If it's not killing the old people that it's given to, let them try. Story from the Wall Street Journal, China's tech clampdown is spreading. Well, of course it is. General Secretary Xi is a totalitarian. He's been in charge. He's taking on more and more authority and more control, like he did in Hong Kong, crushing Hong Kong, like he did with the Uyghurs, putting them in the concentration camps. So, yes, his regulators are cutting down on big tech titans. He doesn't want a Silicon Valley there making decisions about speech that he believes belong to him. Meanwhile, Meghan and Harry have a baby. Lilibet Diana Mountbatten Windsor. Lilibet is for her grandmother. Looks like Netanyahu is done in Jerusalem, done in Israel. Netanyahu bemoans incitement, doesn't want his members causing violence, but he condemns an emerging dangerous left-wing coalition. One Likud member said that Bennett and Sar are like suicide bombers facing death sentence. That's really incendiary, and she was roundly criticized. And then if you get the Financial Times, fascinating story I'll come back and tell about it. Egypt has a new administrative capital. One of those stories you don't know about until you read the Financial Times. I'll tell you about it after the break, America. Happy birthday, Fetching Mrs. Hewitt. We'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hey, you Steve Terrell with the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt song on her birthday. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt in the Beltway, joined now by Selena Zito, who's written about my favorite city not named Warren, Erie, Pennsylvania, home of Camp Notre Dame, where I would spend summer weeks, and I keep adding, please, please, please support Angel Tree. Hello, Selena. Good Monday to you.
Good Monday to you as well.
So you were back up in Erie, and they are having an election for county executive. Now, I don't know how Pennsylvania, they're called covens in Pennsylvania, not county. In Louisiana, they're parishes. In 48 states, they're counties. And in Pennsylvania, they're called the local coven. So who is running the coven up in Erie right now?
Well, I think that the interesting race is, the interesting candidate is the one who just won, Tyler Titus, who just won the Democratic nomination to run in the general in November. And so Tyler Titus is a transgender male. Was formerly a female, and has a lot of ink has been spilled on the fact that Tyler is the first transgender to win an office like this, and he hasn't won the office yet, but has won sort of the nomination. Now, the point of my story is, The race cannot be about that. And so far, a lot of ink has been spilled about that. And as we all know, all politics is local. It's about, do you keep the trains running on time? Do you, you've got to have a budget for the county. You've got to be able to work across the aisle. You've got to be a good manager. It can't just be about a cultural issue. And so I think that is what is most important to the voters in Erie County. But the national attention has been about being the first trans candidate.
I'm going to ask you about the Republican in a second, but tell me first, what are Tyler's qualifications to be a county executive in a county that is very diverse, also tourism-based? It owns a lot of lakefront land and therefore is probably enjoying the kind of boomlet there is going on wherever there's a water shore. What is Tyler's argument that he's qualified for this job?
School board president. He ran for school board 2 years ago and was elected to be the school board president a year later by his fellow school board members.
And do you know if the school board is elected at large or by district?
It is elected by district.
Okay,
what is interesting to me, the schools have been closed for most of the year in the city. Not all the schools in Erie, but the city school district, of which Tyler is the school board president. And none of the school boards, there's a lot of course, as there have been across the country, a lot of sort of controversy about keeping the schools closed. And none of the incumbent school board members ran again for re-election.
So the Democrat nominee for county executive is a transgendered man who won a school board race in a district in a city and then was elected by his colleagues to be the school board chairman for 1 year. And on the basis of that resume, Tyler wants to run the entire county of Erie?
That would be yes.
Okay, yeah. So tell me about the Republican.
So the Republican is a former military and owns his own construction business.
So you mean he has real administrative skills and has signed the front of a check as well as the back of a check?
This exactly, and a very successful construction business as well. It's not just something this sort of there's a As you know, in eastern Ohio, western Pennsylvania, and all across the country, there can be these small little side businesses. He has a very good, successful construction business in the area.
So, you know, I say in my mind, okay, school board, 2 years versus construction company. Does the construction guy have any other public office experience?
No, has never run before. Yeah. Before office.
And Celine, I want to give you the last 30 seconds, but every time I've elected a county official, or Cubbins, as we say in Pennsylvania, all I care about is that they are not cheats and unethical, and that they know a little bit about running something, because counties waste a lot of money. And so this one, I think the Republican would win if I were in charge of everything.
Democrats traditionally win this seat. However, I think that this is going to be a very competitive race, and I do think the Republican does stand a chance of being able to win this race. People want a good manager for this position, in particular after a pandemic where there's been a lot of economic stress in the area. So that's what people are looking for.
Did you swing by Camp Notre Dame, Selena?
No, I don't.
Next trip. Thank you, Selena Zito. Her column in the Washington Examiner, I've already put it up on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt on Twitter. Get ye there and come on right back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Good morning, glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. It's Monday. I'm joined by Jake Sherman, editor-in-chief of PunchbowlNews.com. You can sign up for the morning bulletin from punchbowlnews.com for free, and I read it every morning. Good morning, Jake. How are you?
Hi, Hugh. How are you?
I'm great. Before I get to the big stories, and there really are only a couple, I want to ask you about the Wall Street Journal story this morning that the summer job market for teens is sweet. It goes through all the number of places that teenagers can work. So I'm asking some guests, Jake, what was your first summer job?
I was a lifeguard. I worked pretty much my entire youth at my sleepaway camp in Madison, Connecticut, and I did various jobs, including, you know, worked in the kitchen a little bit, worked as a counselor, and worked at the pool for most of my childhood.
Well, that's what I did. I think lifeguarding is probably the easiest job and the best job to do. My brothers worked in mills in the Warren, Ohio region, and they all got burned and they had to work hard. I took the outdoor. Now, you have to pay for that when you get older and check with your dermatologist all the time. But do you remember what you were paid for your summer work as a high school kid?
I actually don't. I remember my friend tried to get a raise, and we asked him what his negotiation tactic would be. And he said I was just going to ask, and if they said no, I'd say okay. So I don't remember what I got paid. It was not a lot of money.
When we get to the doldrums, I hope Punchbowl News asks all the electeds what their summer job was, because I think lifeguard will win going away. Maybe restaurant work, but as you know, there isn't any reason for any teenager in America not to be working right now, because there are jobs galore out there. Jake, the big story is not really a story, and I began the story, the show with the rundown. Manchin will not support Democrats' voting rights bill in the Washington Post. Manchin vows to block Democrat voting rights bill and preserve filibuster in the New York Times. Democratic senator says he will vote against Biden voting rights bill in the Financial Times, and it just goes on and on. Joe Manchin didn't say anything he hadn't been saying for months, right?
We point that out this morning. I don't know what people are not understanding here. And I will give you credit, Hugh. I thought there was a little bit of openness, and you said there never was with him at the way beginning, and you were right. He's not going to vote to get rid of the filibuster. I don't know how many different ways people could say, you know, people could say it. He has said he's against S1. So now it's the Democrats, I would say, opportunity or moment that they could, and I don't, this is going to sound bad and I don't mean it to, but they could play to their lowest common denominator. Joe Manchin in this case is their outlier, but they have to play to him because that's the Senate and that's how it works. They're not going to beat him. There's no way that they are going to be able to knock him out of office. So they have to cater to him.
And I think, by the way, he's getting a lot of fruit baskets from his colleagues because I believe Maggie Hassan is against changing the filibuster. Have you asked her?
Everyone's been asked, and I there have been various degrees of, you know, let's look at it to no, I won't do it. I mean, listen, the truth is Manchin and Sinema are catching all the flack for their Democratic colleagues who don't want to do it. And by the way, the filibuster in many cases is not even the issue, right? I mean, you saw with the minimum wage, there were 8 Democrats against it. So, I mean, it's not as neat and clean as progressives want you to think it is.
Well, in fact, Angus King uses one of those artful. I like Angus King a lot. He's a guest on this show, and I think he's a terrific senator for Maine. And in combination with Susan Collins, are the best represented state with the most influence in the United States. Cut number 11, Angus King on State of the Union yesterday with another Jake Tapper.
Not in general. I'm very reluctant about it. But if it comes down to voting rights and the rights of Americans to go to the polls and select their leaders versus the filibuster, I'll choose democracy.
Okay, so the way he phrased that, Jake Sherman, if it comes down to it, means if it was the filibuster after we got to 50-50 votes or 51 votes on SB1, he'd vote to change the filibuster. Well, there aren't 51 votes. There aren't even 50 votes for SB1. Ooh. And so that's a great way of not answering the question.
Well, correct. That's absolutely right. And there are some people who have called for an exemption to the filibuster when it comes to voting rights. That's not going to happen either. So, you know, advocates of voting rights legislation, and there are many on both sides of the aisle, are going to have to find another way out of this maze other than blowing up the filibuster.
So my objection generally to the filibuster reporting is that Sinema and Manchin are taking all the heat, which distorts the understanding of the public about where the actual Senate is. I believe Maggie Hassan is against it, but it should be asked of her repeatedly, at least as often as Joe Manchin, because she's up for re-election. So should Senator Kelly get asked in Arizona, because he's up for re-election. I believe Angus King is not up for re-election, right? He's not up this year. And but anyone up for re-election should be asked this, because that's why Joe Manchin's not going to move. He took a very bold stance, right, between the general and the runoffs in Georgia.
And also, there's no political upside for him. I mean, he has created a certain brand in West Virginia, and he's just not going to stray from that. And, I think there are a lot of Republicans who are, as you put it, are sending him fruit baskets and flowers. And I think basically, to be frank, there's not many places Democrats could go now. I mean, Joe Manchin has been talking about the John Lewis voter rights bill, which is another voting rights bill, a lot more modest than S1. And listen, that could be an option. If Democrats want to pass a voting rights bill, they're going to have to look elsewhere.
And they're going to have to work with Republicans, because the filibuster is not going anywhere in America. But we should find out from every senator explicitly, and they ought to all be asked as often as Joe Manchin has been asked, because they are all the same obstacle, one vote. Jake, I want to move to three stories. The New York Times, USA to Central America hasn't slowed migration, can Kamala Harris? Then Frank Booney's column yesterday in the New York Times, Kamala Harris can't win. And then the New York Times story, Democratic report raises 2022 alarms on messaging and voter outreach. Now, on Friday, I was on with Jonathan Capehart and Donna Edwards on the Washington Post First Look, and they were arguing that Kamala Harris is being given the job of migration and being given the job of Voting Rights Act because Joe Biden trusts her a lot. And excuse me for being cynical. She's being given those jobs because they're no-win jobs that the president doesn't want to take the loss for. Who's right, they or me?
I think I tend to think you are. I'm not sure that's the reason why, but they are no-win jobs for Vice President Harris. But there's a history of that, of the vice president getting kind of garbage jobs. Mike Pence got voter fraud in the beginning of the Trump administration and COVID. So, I mean, it's the latest in a long line of, shove it onto the vice president's plate.
Now, given that Joe Biden may be a one-term president, and we're far away from that, but a lot of people assume he isn't, does that hurt Senator Harris's, now Vice President Harris's, quest for the nomination if she has not done anything on the border and has not done anything to get voting rights passed when it comes time to pick a nominee?
I don't know the answer to that. I think when it comes time to pick a nominee, what Democrat is going to go out there and run against the sitting vice president? That's the question that I have, and I don't know that there's an answer to that. I don't know what you think, who you think that is, Hugh, but I just don't know who's going to come out and run against the sitting vice president.
Oh, I think there will be many, many people because of her weakness in the first round. I think I was always always long on Kamala Harris. I'm still long on her political fortunes, but her campaign torqued into downdraft so quickly that a lot of people will think she can't run a campaign and will show up because, you know, just because your vice president like Dan Quayle showing up in 2000 doesn't mean you're going to get past George W. Bush. And so there are governors out there who will, like Gavin Newsom, it could be intramural in the California role. So I just think getting stuck with losers is not great for her. It's like adding rocks in the pockets of someone who's getting dumped in the water.
But then again, if migration slows, which it has a little bit, and if they pass something on voting rights, anything, then those are two big victories that she could spin as big victories, even if they're not exactly what the Democratic base wants.
Oh, yeah, if she got those, but she's not going to get those. Last question. I like Tony Fauci a lot. Dr. Fauci's been on the show a couple of times. I've approached the COVID thing as everyone's trying to do the best they can. Nobody wants millions to die, and people make mistakes. He has certainly made mistakes, as of Dr. Collins, as has Rochelle Walensky, as did the Trump team. Is it time for Dr. Fauci to leave center stage? Because now he's down to MSNBC and Rachel Maddow, who's a fine reporter and a good show, but it's playing to the left side of the audience and only the left side of the audience. What do you think, Jake?
Oh, I don't know the answer to that. I will say this. It's been a little bit quizzical that people have been surprised by these emails, considering, if you remember, and I'm sure you do, Hugh, Fauci was against masks publicly at the beginning. So his being against masks in his emails is no different than him being against masks publicly, which he was. So,
and it's crazy to me that we're discovering the lab theory. Tom Cotton on this show in February of 2020 announced it was the lab. And I followed that story all year long. And Jim Garrity followed that story all year. All of a sudden, it's caught up. I just don't get it, Jake. Sometimes it seems to me that reporting just locks in on a narrative and never looks anywhere else than the narrative.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. And especially with an issue like this that is just so complicated and so opaque, I think that I think people get themselves in trouble.
PunchbowlNews.com, America. Go and read it every morning. Get up to speed on what's happening inside the Beltway from Jake Sherman and his crew at Punchbowl News. Coming right back, 1-800-520-1234. Connection to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Each word your tenderness grows.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. The Fetching Mrs. Hewitt's birthday. So I always play our favorite song and her favorite song at the beginning of each break, even when Congressman Mike Gallagher is joining me from Wisconsin. Good morning, Congressman. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Happy birthday to your wonderful wife. My daughter, who was born almost a year ago around this time, just woke up. So she's also wishing happy birthday to your wife.
Oh, my goodness. You got a one-year-old in the house? Are you holding her?
My wife is holding her right now, but she will soon be making weird noises in the background. So this adds
That's
a little
great
color to our interview here.
It's the very best sort of background noise, or kids screaming or dogs barking, and I love it. Congressman, will you help me? My wife has a request for her birthday.
Here we go.
She'd like to know why the Packers didn't go for it on fourth down. She really is interested in this, and she's not much of a football fan, so I said I'd ask.
Oh, boy, Hugh.
All right, let's get going.
Right. Every time I try and be nice.
Let's get going. Look, if the Chinese Communist Party, this is the question of the hour, I've decided it's the question for every would-be presidential candidate, for everyone who comes on, everyone who wants to run for House or the Senate. If the Chinese Communist Party attempts to take over Taiwan by force, whether it is explicit or via espionage by the introduction of little green men of their own variety, what should the United States do?
We should come to the defense of Taiwan. And prior to that, we should start preparing the American people for why this matters. We made some progress in last year's NDAA. We took my Taiwan Defense Act, which focuses on ensuring the Pentagon maintains the capabilities it needs to defeat a so-called fait accompli against Taiwan. And that was a good step forward, getting that passed. But we need to go a step forward and pass my other bill, the Taiwan Invasion Prevention Act, which would officially end this policy of strategic ambiguity and establish a standing authorization for the use of military force to defend Taiwan. We simply need to jettison the complacency we have when balancing Taiwan and China and come down firmly on the side of Taiwan in order to deter an invasion that certainly seems more likely today than even a few years ago. I mean, you have Avril Davidson out there saying they could make a move on Taiwan in the next 6 years. And I fear that many of America's elites, particularly those in the financial community who continue to make the majority of their gains off growth in Asia in general, China in particular, aren't pricing in the risk of a Taiwan scenario. To the extent they see it as a risk, it's a distant tail risk. So, end the policy of strategic ambiguity, continue selling our friends in Taiwan the resources they need in order to deter an invasion, and start to talk to the American people about why this matters.
Now, there are thousands of Americans who live in Taiwan, thousands of Americans who live there. I know a couple of them. That should not be, however, the reason that we would act with force to meet force, but because they are a democratic ally and we have always, strategic ambiguity has just been a nice way around saying we would defend the island nation with force. Now, my question, though, Congressman, you mentioned the big if the American people are prepared to do so. Do you think they are for a shooting war, for a hot war, for anything that involves American casualties?
Well, I think there's certainly a sentiment within the country that, tragically and somewhat ironically, is shared on both sides, that just wants to turn inward and focus on so-called nation building at home, to revive a old Obama phrase that used to infuriate me. But I think that makes it all the more incumbent upon people in public office to make the case for why we have to be forward engaged, why Taiwan is to the new Cold War what Berlin was to the old. And as for why it matters, I just would add, certainly democracy is important, defending democratic allies and partners. That affects our own credibility as well. The geography of Taiwan and where it sits within the First Island Chain makes it important. But there's a couple other things that I think people fail to recognize sometimes. One is that, you know, you allow this to happen, it could create a nuclear cascade and rise the risk of a regional war, given, you know, the role of Japan and India might play as well. And then the other that, you know, affects every American who drives is the fact that Taiwan is critical for semiconductor manufacturing. The world's largest semiconductor manufacturer, TSMC, is located in Taiwan. And without Taiwan, our things turn off and they start falling down from the sky. And we give General Secretary Xi Jinping a tool with which he can hold the entire world hostage. So, again, despite the fact that, you know, international engagement and forward defense and supporting allies may no longer be in vogue, that just means our task is more important to start making these arguments, because I fear the complete collapse of American deterrence if we allow this to happen. And as far-fetched as it may seem, if you're Xi Jinping and you're sitting there, you look at America and you feel like, wow, they're politically very divided against themselves. Two, the Russians seem to have gotten away with invading a country, and the Biden administration just gave them a gift with Nord Stream 2. Now might be a good time in order to press the limit, pursue these gains. This summer is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party. What better way to celebrate it than this incredible legacy achievement? And I do believe this is Xi's legacy. This is what he views as critical to his legacy.
Now, Crimea is bigger than Taiwan. And I want people to understand that a nation state can fall rather quickly. Even an independent island nation like Taiwan can be overwhelmed unless they have the superpower ally. What would our force look like if they began to assemble a battle force? We would obviously know it was coming if they are doing the invasion route, not the Little Green Men route, but if they were doing it, we would know it was coming. What sort of steps would you imagine we would take before and during such an attack?
Well, I would imagine the carrier that right now is being diverted away from the Pacific in order to help with the Afghanistan withdrawal would, turn around and head the other way. All the more reason why the early details of the Biden defense budget are so troubling, in particular because they're going to hurt the Navy, reduce the number of ships we have, and yet again, it's like Lucy and Charlie Brown with football when it comes to rebuild the Navy. Then I think we'd just be looking at what other naval assets we'd have in the region. As we've talked about many times, Hugh, one of the most important steps we took in the last 4 years was getting out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which theoretically allowed to field intermediate range ground launch missiles with, you know, range between 500 and 5,500 nautical miles. But yet we haven't made much progress on that, in part because we need basing agreements with our allies. And so I'm just afraid right now we do not have the deterrent posture we need in order to deny even a, you know, highly conventional invasion by the PLA Navy, right? Now, I think a hybrid strategy is more likely, some sort of, you know, little green man scenario combined with conventional assets. But in either case, I just worry that we don't have the force posture in the Indo-Pacific and in the First Island Chain that we need in order to prevent this from happening.
Now, the PLA will try and land troops from the air. Taiwan will shoot at those airplanes and at those paratroopers if they attempt to land either at existing airstrips or via that. And they're violating Taiwan airspace every day. Will we shoot at those planes? And would Virginia-class submarines send torpedoes or other underwater devices at Chinese People's Liberation Army Navy ships headed for Taiwan?
Well, if they fire the first shot, I think we'd have to. You know, again, we're stuck in this policy of strategic ambiguity where it leaves some, you know, measure of interpretation as to what we would do. But we'd have one of our closest allies, an ally that came to our help in the early stages of the pandemic, donated hundreds of thousands of masks to states like Wisconsin, an ally that's on the front lines of freedom, an ally that is a living counterpoint to the idea that the Chinese people somehow do not want or cannot handle democracy under attack. I think it would be in our interest and the interest of the free world to respond in order to prevent this from happening. And I wouldn't take anything off the table at all. I would start sinking Chinese ships. You know, there was a great notion that emerged last year, and it was a bipartisan notion that I think originally started with Michelle Flournoy, who at the time was rumored to be the Secretary of Defense pick, where she said we need to start planning around the idea that we need to put every PLA ship on the bottom of the ocean within 72 hours of the outbreak of a conflict. And I think that is a great thing to start planning around. And the other aspect of this discussion is, what are our allies, particularly Japan and Australia, willing to do? So, you know, I've been on the Armed Services Committee now for 5 years, Hugh, and I keep saying this basic fundamental point, and no one has been able to answer me. Why haven't we been in a room, you know, with the CNO, with the Commandant of the Marine Corps, with the SecDef, Secretary of the Navy? By the way, we still don't have a Secretary of the Navy. Biden administration is screwing that one up big time right now. And just sat around a map and said, you know, here's what we think the Chinese are going to do, and here's what we need to do, and here's what we need from you, Congress, in order to be able to do these things. That basic planning conversation has never happened. And to that point, the Biden administration would be smart to invite certain members of Congress into their wargaming on this issue, so that we can be better advocates for what the Pentagon needs in order to prevent World War III from happening. And that's what we're talking about, Hugh. As we look at Biden's budget, you know, it's crazy. They're spending more domestically than we've ever spent since World War II, and yet they're not willing to spend the minimum necessary to prevent World War III. That tells you how screwed up their priorities are right now.
Now, this audience is going to get bored with this because I'm going to ask everyone again and again and again, but I want to go back. Have you participated in a war game involving the CCP moving against Taiwan explicitly or via dark arts?
I have not participated in it because we usually get briefed on the outcome of these war games. And I wrote an op-ed late last year arguing that the Pentagon should invite us into their entire war games. I've made the request to the CNO as of last week and repeatedly to the Commandant for the last year. You know, they assure me that it's going to happen, but I'm willing to fly anywhere at any time to be part of these. You know, I get it. I'm only, you know, 260-something in seniority in the House, but I tend to pay attention to these issues, and I really do think it would benefit the Pentagon to invite us into that process. So usually we get the outcome. We're not there to watch it unfold.
Because it's always what do you do first and the time frame. Most people assume we'd have months to get ready. We won't have weeks. We won't have days. If they do this, it's in the interest of the Chinese Communist Party to do it quickly with overwhelming force. Am I right about that assumption?
That's 100% correct. That's the essence of the fait accompli strategy, because if you achieve it and plant facts on the ground, well, then we're left having to surge assets from other regions of the world or even domestically in the United States. And then it's very easier for them to extend their anti-access era denial capabilities to keep us out. So it will be very hard to dislodge them if they take territory on Taiwan. And that's why we need a denial posture, not a punishment posture, not something that says we're going to punish you after the fact, a posture that says we will deny you in real time your ability to achieve this objective.
And people need to think about that now, and we're going to continue. It's the most important question because it's, I'm afraid we're imminent. I think it's imminent. Write it down, June 7th, 2021. I think it's imminent. Congressman Mike Gallagher, thank you for joining me on this, the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt's birthday. But we didn't get the birthday present she was. She wanted to know why the Packers folded up like a lawn chair. Because she was kind of pulling for the Packers. My friend John Yeager is a Packer fan, so she was rooting for the Packers. You know, I got to send the Packers relieffactor.com. There you go, relieffactor.com. Mark Murphy, who's the president and CEO of the Packers, is an old pal, and known him for years. Back when our kids were young, we go to the same swimming club in Northern Virginia, and he's up there trying to run the Packers, and I haven't asked Mark yet why they didn't go for it on fourth down, but we should send him some relieffactor.com. I'm reminding you, summer is not yet officially here, but it's close. And it certainly feels like summer inside the Beltway. Do yourself a favor. Get relieffactor.com. Get outside. Get walking. Get going. Back, America. Happy birthday, Fetching Mrs. Hewitt. That's Mel Torme with her song. I'm joined by Josh Kroshauer, Hotline Josh on Twitter. Good morning, Josh. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh.
I would like to ask a kind of a loaded question. How is it that political media can find Senators Manchin and Sinema to ask about the filibuster over and over and over again, but they can't find Senators Hassan and Kelly to do the same thing?
Well, you're raising a very important point, Hugh, which is that I think one of the underexplored angles of this whole debate is that Manchin and Sinema, who don't have re-elections until 2024, so they have some political capital, they have some political insulation, they're protecting the more moderate Democrats up for re-election next year. Mark Kelly is one of them. You also have you named them. I mean, you named Cortez Masto in Nevada as well. These folks don't want to talk. They don't want to vote to remove the filibuster. They're not fully on board. I guess they co-sponsored the Senate, the voting rights bill that House Democrats are championing, but they're not comfortable with a lot of provisions privately themselves. So their Manchin and to some extent Sinema are protecting the more moderate Democrats on a ballot next year from having to take tough positions, having to take uncomfortable votes.
Well, they are. But the media is also protecting them. I'm getting to that, Josh, because they find Manchin and Sinema, who are probably getting baskets of flowers and fruit cakes from their colleagues, Hassan and Kelly, for taking all the heat. But that doesn't mean that Politico and Axios and Hotline and every other reporter up there, The Post and The New York Times, should not be prowling the halls looking for Senator Hassan and Kelly, asking them again and again and again, has their view on the filibuster changed? Because what's good for the goose is good for the gander, right?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think I agree that, like, so often we kind of look at the divisions within the Republican Party, and you talk to Republicans and what they think about Trump or what they think about something controversial that he said. There are a lot of divisions in the Democratic Party now on the filibuster, on HR1. Also on, the squad regularly makes comments that are quite extreme. I don't hear a lot of moderate Democrats being asked about what they think about some of the more intemperate comments of their colleagues. So, yeah, I do think there's too often there's a double standard that, the divisions in both parties are not explored. It's only when Trump says something controversial that you see a swarm of press asking every Republican what they think about it.
Now, I'm just looking at John Berman posted Representative Jamal Bowman of New York saying that Joe Manchin has become the new Mitch McConnell. Joe Manchin is doing everything in his power to stop democracy. Now, that's just absurd, right? And CNN should have said, what about John Berman should have said, what about Senator Hassan? What about Senator Kelly? He didn't. That's what I'm talking about, Josh.
Yeah, I was watching some CNN this morning, and I think they did bring on their political analyst talking about how Joe Manchin, if he wasn't taking these positions, he'd be replaced by a Republican who supports the Republican agenda 100% of the time. So, I don't think Democrats and maybe folks who cover this issue don't appreciate the politics of West Virginia and, frankly, the politics in much of the country.
My point's different. If they have a Democratic congressman on and he takes a shot at Joe Manchin, that Democratic congressman should be asked, well, what about Maggie Hassan? What about Mark Kelly? And how do you know that they're not the same way? And they can't answer that, Josh. So not only is Manchin taking all the heat, they're giving a pass to these people, and they're not asking the Democrat or the left-wing commentators the real question, which is there aren't 52 votes or 50. There's lots of opposition to changing the filibuster.
Yeah, no doubt. And, I mean, look, when Jamal Bowman says that one of the most important Democratic senators in the caucus is like Mitch McConnell, that's a big story. That's something that should be, you know, front page news, that should be, you know, leading a lot of the cable news channels. You're not seeing those divisions being amplified. I mean, these are major divisions within the Democratic Party, and that you need to have moderate Democrats like Manchin if Democrats have any hopes of maintaining their majority. And yet you have these very left-wing, they make comments on Twitter. They say all kinds of nutty things, and they almost get a pass. You know, you don't see the same scrutiny of their remarks. And
the question is why? Why is that the case? Why do they not get the follow-up question from John Berman or responses from other mainstream media? Why does that happen, Josh?
Well, I mean, you could certainly blame the media. I'm not going to dispute that there are shows, there are outlets that don't give Democrats the same degree of scrutiny that they give Republicans. We've talked about the business models, Hugh, that, you know, these days there's no middle anymore. There's not as much of a business incentive to kind of just report the facts, hold every side accountable. I've seen that on a lot of shows. The typical reporting, typical scrutiny, holding all sides accountable is more pronounced on when it comes to Republicans than when it comes to folks. When it comes to Trump.
I just think it's because it's completely broken. Political reporting should be straight news, and they're obvious questions. Josh, it's always a pleasure. Follow him on Twitter at Hotline Josh. Remember, over at The Interview with Hugh Hewitt, my long conversation with Jonah Goldberg is up. The Rundown is also up. And to the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt, thank you for saying yes 40 years ago tonight on the top of the Kennedy Center. Happy birthday, sweetie. I'll be back tomorrow, America, on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
Just the way you look tonight. Just